Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello, and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, Anna Pajaisky, and this episode I talk to artist and forager Flora Arbuthnot about natural dyes. This was recorded online, and for a reason that I can't actually explain, there are a few distracting sort of audio farts peppered throughout this conversation, I think caused by the recording equipment, but hopefully they're not too distracting from all the amazingly brilliant and insightful things that Flora has got to say. I started by asking Flora how she first got interested in natural dyeing.
So my mother is a printmaker, so I grew up around textiles. So she was always doing screen printing when I was a child, and she taught me how to do screen printing. So from very early on, it was my first craft, and I've continued throughout my life. And then I went on to art school to study product design, and I had a general interest in materials and design, and art, illustration. And I grew up rurally in the countryside and had an appreciation for the natural environment, but didn't really realise it, how important it was to me, until I went to art school in Glasgow, which is a very urban environment, and started to feel something was missing. And we were learning about design, but it was very much from a very intellectual and human-centered perspective, with materials that were coming already quite very highly processed materials. Yeah. So wood that was already processed into planks and plastic and sheets, or in already very highly processed materials. Yeah. And I felt a disconnect, and I felt it both in myself, in my life, in the urban life there, and also a disconnect in working with these materials and that of where they came from and the story of those. I learned about permaculture, and that was a real light bulb moment, because it's a design methodology about integration with natural systems and cycles. And so when I was a student, I was starting to try and figure out how to integrate that into my work, and within an environment where it was seen to be innovative to have a human-centered perspective, but the other natural world was not considered. So when I left art school, I started working in service design, and because that was the industry I'd been prepared for, but I was continued to be not satisfied and not really know how to have the pieces to kind of integrate this other interest I had in the wider natural world. And eventually I started growing and growing vegetables and plants, and then I came to learn about natural dyeing, which I hadn't even really heard about. I'd been doing printmaking, but I hadn't known about natural dyeing, and it was just I could see how it brought together all of my interests into one practice in terms of my fascination with plants growing and foraging, as well as my interest in visual art and design. And I like to have a practice that's very varied. So I love with natural dyeing that my practice involves both growing, foraging, processing plants, making dyes, making inks, printing, dyeing, preparing fabric. There's a very different many different activities involved that I enjoy, that varied aspect. And also the chemistry. I studied chemistry for A-level and I've always really enjoyed chemistry. So that I enjoy how it brings in the science as well as the art. I also have become increasingly on this journey, all this, increasingly interested in what does it mean to be, the questions around what does it mean to be human, and the history of humankind. And I'm fascinated by there's the history of humankind. We spent over 200,000 years living as hunter-gatherers, and only 10 to 15,000 years as settled farming people. And then in terms of the history of crafts and natural dyes, it's only been in the past 200 years that we've started using industrially processed materials.
Right.
So and I'm interested in the kind of lives that we are adapted to live, and how we've kind of turned away from those lives, and now we live much more modern lives that don't necessarily meet those wild parts of ourselves, and well, deny certain parts of ourselves, wild parts of ourselves. And so I'm interested, I have been exploring practices that can integrate those parts of ourselves that we have denied back into welcome those parts back in. And for me, that's mostly through my connection with plants and crafts, also practices like tracking and hunting and bird language as well. So, and I've spent some time, I went out to visit the San Bushmen in the Kalahari Desert, and they are a great inspiration to me in terms of how we can, as humans in this time, reconnect with what it means to be human in an ancient way that may be more fulfilling in some ways and more connected with the natural world.
Amazing. There's so much to unpack from what you've just said. It would be good, I think, to start with, to discuss kind of what we mean by natural dyes. So sort of the materials and the processes that you work with.
Yeah, so practically speaking, I have fibres that I work with. So those are either plant-based fibres, so usually either linen or cotton or paper that's made of other cellulose fibers, tree fibers or cotton fibers. And I tend to group those as cellulose fibers. And then I also work with animal based fibers, so that tends to be wool or silk, and those tend to be made of protein, so they respond differently. Those are the materials that I'm applying the color to. And then I'm working with the plants that I'm creating the color from. And those are either wild plants that I find locally, or plants that have been specifically bred for dyeing. So over the past few thousand years, they've been, like vegetables, have been specifically bred for eating.
Yeah.
And then I also use certain chemicals to either brighten the colours, make the colours more stable, or modify the colours, or assist in the processes in other ways. And these tend to be the metal salts or pH shifters, so acids or alkalis. And some of those are naturally derived. So some of them I can directly source those from plants. Whereas others I have used synthesized chemicals that are essentially white powders.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So what are some of the plants that we might have heard of that can produce dyes that you use?
Yeah, so I mean, the obvious place to start is the kitchen, I suppose. So we have onion skins and avocado skins and pips. So onion skins give orange and avocado skins give pink.
Oh, really?
And there are also plants in the kitchen that people may think of as dye plants that are actually not dye plants because they're not stable, like berries and turmeric isn't stable as a dye.
Oh, really?
Any kind of fruits, beetroots, they don't really work very well. So, and there's also garden plants like roses or marigolds, and tree barks like apple bark or pear bark or acorns, oak galls. So there's a wide variety of different types of plant materials, from roots to barks to flowers and leaves.
Amazing. And are you after kind of certain pigments? I suppose it is pigments, isn't it? But what are the kind of substances that you're trying to get out of those materials?
I'm not a chemist.
Yep.
Although I have a basic understanding of chemistry, so I can't give detail in that way.
Yeah.
But so there are different pigments or chemicals or acids that we can get from different plants. So with madder, let's say, which is a plant which is traditionally created, the roots are traditionally used for red. We're extracting a chemical called alizarin from the roots, and it's very specific in terms of, like, the alizarin is only released if the roots are heated up between 60 and 80 degrees.
Okay.
So it's a very specific extraction. You can even cold extract some madder multiple times to wash it before heating it up to that temperature, just to get the pure alizarin. And then many plants give tannic acid, which is a fantastic dye, which can either be used as a fixative for other dyes, and also can be used in combination with iron to create black and grey.
Oh, right.
Those are a couple of examples. And then also there's indigo, which is a pigment that's extracted from various different plants all around the world. So indigo is the blue pigment. But what's intriguing about indigo is that there's many different plants that contain the potential to produce indigo. And all those plants aren't related to each other.
Okay.
So there's, in the UK, we have woad, which is in the cabbage family. And then we have Japanese indigo, which is a Persicaria, so that's a knotweed. And then we have Indigo ferratinctoria, which is grown in Asia and Africa, and that is a legume. But all those different plants are all used to produce indigo.
Amazing. Yeah, the listeners won't be able to see you on screen, but I can see that you're sitting in, is it your studio? With lots of different plants behind you, and a lovely kind of colour chart directly behind where you're sitting with all sorts of different colours on it. It's amazing the kind of range that is possible.
Yeah, that chart is only made with about 4 plants.
Oh, really? And there's about, 15, 20 different colours produced?
So that's, they're shifted by mixing. So often I use, so green is the most difficult colour to produce because chlorophyll, that is green in nature, is ultimately unstable. It's a living cell.
Cool.
That's why in the autumn all the green dyes, we end up with browns, which is the most common colour to get dyeing. So to create a stable green, I combine a yellow and a blue. So I create, the greens on that chart are created through combining indigo with weld. And then the colours are shifted with pH, so shifting it, whether it's acids tend to make the colours paler, and then alkalis make them darker. And then, adding iron oxide tends to make colours more grey. And then you can also dilute the colours with a with a solvent to make them lighter or paler.
They are surprisingly vibrant, though. I had an assumption that natural dyes would be quite sort of muted colours, but there are some really bright ones on there.
Yeah, yeah, that's a big part of my mission, really, of my work, is to demonstrate how it's possible to create colours, natural colours, that can be as vibrant as synthetic dyes. And I think that's a really important part of my work, because people have a lot of assumptions with natural dyes being all beige and brown and muted. And as if before the 1800s, everything was just beige, which isn't true. There was a huge, many very vibrant colours that were used.
Yeah.
And the colours had more stories to them and meaning and significance, whereas now it's less so somehow.
Yeah, made in factories. Actually, that brings me really nicely onto the next question that I had for you, which was sort of about, I'm interested in what the significance of natural dyeing is compared to synthetic dyes. You kind of hinted at it there, that there's a much richer history and a bit more of a story behind the materials as opposed to the synthetic side, which is much more modern and tends to be created in, I suppose, laboratories and chemical factories. I suppose to you, sort of, what's the significance of natural dyeing?
So for me, the significance is, it's about the story. It's about the connection with the plants, the honesty of it, of working with those raw materials, growing them or foraging them, meeting them in where they live, and working with them to create these colours, and creating colours that have a story to them and are enduring in the way that I generally like to teach. And often, rather than doing commissions, and often when people approach me to do commissions, I do the commissions with them, because for me, just the object isn't as interesting and it's not as rewarding as to have the relationship with how it's been created. And so I'm not so interested in just providing a finished product. It's about bringing people along in the experience of that, and then of that process, and then creating the object at the end, which then will be so much more enduring, because the person who is living with that piece of fabric, piece of clothing, has a deeper, much deeper relationship with it, and is much more likely to take care of it, to repair it, to share it, and has a story to tell about it, and it's a much deeper relationship than if someone's just bought something or from a shop, or and only appreciates it for the visual aesthetic, which without any kind of understanding of the story of why that is and what that's about.
I suppose I'm curious about how you mentioned about sort of reconnecting with the natural world as a way of potentially getting back to what it means to be human. But how does your process sort of reflect that change?
So it's a big question. I mean, what does it mean to be human? And I expect that everyone has their own journey around that question. And that's kind of based on and we all have our own relationship with that. So So what I share is kind of my own personal perspective, rather than creating any big proclamations. But for me, there's something of being part of to be being human is to be a part of the natural cycles of life, of all life. and finding a way back to being rather than doing, and to be, and because I see that the culture we have created is creates meaning through what we do rather than just being a human being. So I found that through practices such as, well, particularly foraging, being in the seasons and creating a cycle, finding my own cycle where I live of locally available plants that I work with that I migrate to throughout this year. And that's, you know, maybe like in, maybe that in June I always go to a particular lime tree to harvest the flowers that only have flat flowers for a week every year, and I have a specific journey to that, to the, that tree that I return to. Or and in, it's like August to September I go and forage for mushrooms in the woods that I pretty much only go to at that time of year, and it's, so it's a very specific seasonal cycle, and but it creates a certain relationship with place that's which with the places, which becomes full of stories and full of I feel it makes it, that makes me feel a sense of belonging and connection with place. And there's also something of that state of mind of being while in those kind of practices, which feels very ancient to me and very deeply fulfilling and grounding. So yeah, like in the, like when the acorns and the oak galls start to come down and going out to collect them, and that feeling of I must go and get my year's supply and going out and collecting them, and all that I encounter in through that, that practice, which I find, I mean, yeah, just the idea that, you know, people have been foraging and working with oak for thousands and thousands of years, and to find my relationship with that, and that connects me with a ancient lineage of people, and also gives me a sense of place and connection with my home. And and then I noticed that, you know, I live somewhere, I build up that local, it's a bit like, you know, when you live somewhere for a while, you start to get to know loads of people in your local area, and you start to feel at home. It's like developing that, but with the land and with the plants that live there, and meeting them in this, in the specific seasons that where they have their gifts to offer, and working with them.
Where do you live?
Oh, I live in South Devon.
Okay.
So.
Nice. Yeah. It doesn't sound like you live in a city, I was going to say. I'm in central London. So when you were describing all of that, I was like, ah, oh, the natural world. I miss it so much.
Well, yeah, I did live in the city for cities for 10 years. Yeah. I lived in Glasgow and then London and then Bristol. And I think it's cities can be very abundant for the dye plants. It's amazing. I mean, I've, you know, there's buddleia and oak and many in the parks. There are many different interesting plants and opportunities for foraging. So I don't think it's a practice that's exclusive to the countryside. And actually I find there's something of, when I lived in the city, I was actually much more dedicated to my practice in this way because I had to be in order to be, feel okay. Whereas now I've noticed since living in the countryside, I've become less dedicated to it because I don't, I don't rely on it in order to, yeah, in order to feel connected to the place, because I don't need to go foraging in order to be in the countryside. But, I was amazed in Bristol at how all those little wild edges and kind of forgotten places. And I remember there being this little back alley where there was just lines and lines of roses that just someone had planted, but it was completely forgotten place. And I'd go every June and pick the rose petals, and there'd never be anyone else there. And
amazing.
It was kind of like, it's kind of satisfying, kind of cycling around with my basket in a city and having that kind of connection, finding those little places and having that connection.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In a way, it feels kind of subversive almost, doesn't it? Like, I don't know. Cities are so built up of, I mean, I live in very central London. So, you know, there's so much concrete, so much glass, so much brick, so many hard surfaces. And like you say, you do have these areas where kind of nature is able to grow and thrive. But it almost feels like it shouldn't. It's sort of like, you know, the nature is kind of reclaiming its ground. And there's something as well about city living that you have to pay for everything. You know, in London, you have to pay to get around. You have to pay really expensive rent. Everything comes at a cost. Whereas what you're describing is completely free. I mean,
yeah,
you're not, yeah.
Yeah, well, absolutely. That's a part of it is that it's, yeah. It's empowering in a way that it's about how can we access the materials that we need to have without just through knowledge and wisdom and not through commercial purposes. And there's that part, and it's also about bringing that knowledge back into the commons, because it used to be common knowledge, you know, how to do natural dyeing, how to create herbal medicines, you know, how to weave, how to sew. These would have been all just skills everyone would have had, and now they've been lost. And there's also in some areas, there's quite a bit of secretiveness around those industries and wanting to keep those as specialist knowledge rather than common knowledge. Mm. And I've been really enjoying through the internet, through online communities, creating a commons, a culture of bringing natural dyes, inks, paints back into the commons, and how empowering it is for people to be able to access that through. And particularly with this past year, you know, when all those kind of experiences that we can't do and have anymore because they are kind of banned.
Yeah.
But we're still allowed to go out and go for walks and to experience plants and trees. And there's been a big opportunity there to reconnect.
Yeah, for sure.
With that. And I guess we talked a lot about plants and about foraging. And I wonder whether it'd be worth talking more about the processes.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Processes involved in.
Yeah, so maybe you could take me through an example process, you know, from start to finish, from stepping out of your front door to having the final product.
Okay, yeah. So, there are so many different processes.
Yeah.
And the years go by, every few months I'm learning a different process. So it's, and it's kind of infinite in that way. And there are, and it's like there are so many different plants, but there's also so many different ways of working with those. Mm. And it's kind of endless, which is quite enticing about it. But I will, I'll take you through a simple approach. And I like to teach in a way which is teaching quite sort of generic processes that then you can interchange whatever plants are local to you into the process, so that so it's about, it's not just about going and finding a specific plant. So in terms of dyeing, which is, I mean, I make dyes, inks and paints, they'll have slightly different processes, but ultimately I tend to go out and I'll find depends on the time of year. So this time of year, doesn't look like there's much available, but it's a fantastic time of year for harvesting tree barks from now until March, because this time of year, it's the sap is just starting to rise from the roots up into the tree, into the leaves of the trees again. So the energy of the trees is starting to move into the bark of the tree as it rises. So there are many trees that you can, so this time of year I harvest apple bark and pear bark, alder bark. Often from fruit trees, you can just go out and find people who are pruning their trees already. And so you're just taking the bark from prunings rather than taking it from live trees. That's a bit, can be a bit harsh. So so I go to a local orchard and find and ask for from the people managing the orchard the prunings, and I strip the bark, scrape the bark from the branches, and you can tell with bark if you scrape some off and you look at the under layer of the bark, the inner bark, and it may look pale, but after about 5 minutes to half an hour, that bark, the inner bark, will oxidize, and you'll see it'll go darker and it may turn pink or orange or yellow, and see basically what color it will give.
That's cool.
So that's a good way of testing. And then if it's a good bark, I'll just strip as much bark as I have, and then I'll take that bark and then I put it in a bucket of a pan, or I put it in a pan of water. I use stainless steel pans so it's not reactive, and I simmer that bark for a couple of hours, and often I'll steep it sometimes I'll steep it for months, but I could just steep it overnight, and then I remove the bark from that liquid, and that I use that liquid as my dye. So that's a dye, and that's a kind of base which you can then use just to submerge fabric in to dye, or you can add certain ingredients which settles the pigment, so you can make paints with the pigment, you can evaporate the dye down to make an ink, or you can concentrate it down and mix it with a binder for printing with. So there's many different ways you can then use that extracted water-based dye. You just dye fabric, but I'll usually pre-mordant the fabric. So I use one of my favourite mordants is a plant called Simplocus, which isn't actually available in the UK. It's a plant that grows in Southeast Asia. And it's an interesting plant because it's the world's most powerful bioaccumulator in aluminium. So the leaves contain 3% aluminium.
No way.
So and it's been used as a mordant for thousands of years. So I buy the Simplocus leaves and I boil them up and extract the aluminium from the leaves, and then steep my fabric in that liquid before dyeing my fabric with, let's say, the apple bark dye, and that will give me a much brighter color. But you can also use aluminium sulfate, which you can just buy from the chemist, and that's much cheaper and quicker. But I've When I started out, I was very strict about just using plants.
Yeah, so it's much less romantic if you just buy it off the internet. So do you do anything with your fabrics after that point? Do you make sort of clothes and products, or do you just stop at the fabric stage?
I've been just so focused on making plant dyes that I just focus on surface application rather than sewing or or knitting or other extra processes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of increasingly exploring different applications, like painting on fabric and printing on fabric.
Mm.
But definitely for me, it definitely feels like my focus is the plants and the processes for getting the applying the plants to the fabric rather than working with the fabric itself. I'm pretty incompetent at sewing, to be honest.
Well, it's a completely different skill set from what you've been describing so far. So it's fair enough to concentrate on the kind of alchemy of it rather than the end product. Do you have any tips for people who want to kind of get into this or learn a bit more about it? How can people get started with foraging?
If you can go find somebody locally to you who's knowledgeable to take you out, I find the best way to learn is through being directly shown something, particularly when you start out, because it's quite intimidating. There's that wall of green. It's just it's hard to penetrate it, first of all, until you can start to differentiate different families of plants to be able to differentiate. Otherwise, I would say to go out with curiosity and meet what is there rather than going out to look for something in particular.
Okay.
I think that's a really important part of the practice, is to be open to meeting what is there and curious to find out what that particular plant, and notice what you're drawn to, and to go with that and connect with and to give space to that. Because I think it's a kind of abundance perspective. I see it as an abundance perspective. You can go out with open awareness to be able to meet what is there, then there's always something there to learn and to connect with. But if you go out looking for something in particular, you can spend all day hunting and feel quite dissatisfied and kind of a bit lost. Like,
That's such a good metaphor for life. Sorry, I interrupted you. Yeah. Go on.
No, it's true. Yeah, as I just finished. Yeah, it is. And I think I find it helpful going out foraging with that kind of practice, just for foraging, because it actually kind of then starts to seep into other parts of my life. Like, I like the seasonality of the practice, like of working with plants different times of year. And then I start to recognize the seasonality of other parts of my practice, like noticing that in the winter there's not much else going on, so I do a lot of research in my studio, and in the spring then I'm starting to grow dye plants, and so working mostly with plants, and in the summer there's a lot of harvesting of flowers and teaching, and then in the autumn it's the mushrooms and because I think there's both a kind of what's happening out in the world and with the plants, and there's also like what is going on internally, and there's kind of I'm not being very articulate with what I mean, but I mean it's all connected. So there's and it's very different to the way that with normal kind of design process I was taught at art school, a very linear design process, where actually with these crafts and working with the seasons, it's actually a cyclic and seasonal process that's not linear and goes around with the cycle of the moon as well as the cycle of the sun and working with the plants that are available at that time, and it's much more complex in those ways, but I find much more interesting.
It sounds so, it sounds like such a
concept that so many of us have, I think, forgotten or lost track of, is this connection to the natural world and the outside world, particularly those of us that live in cities. You know, you're so kind of blinkered to it physically. You can barely see the sky sometimes because there's such tall buildings around, you know, central heating, not going outdoors, hard materials around you, so you don't actually access the greenery itself. And what you were describing about the kind of cyclic nature of it and kind of tapping into that is something that I think a lot of listeners will relate to wanting to tap into. And so that's why I was interested in kind of how we can start to notice and to kind of get a bit more back out there, if that makes sense. And you're right, this year, that is pretty much the only thing we've been able to do reliably, is to be able to go outdoors and try and find that sort of stuff. Are there any sort of good books on this sort of stuff or sort of other resources?
So my practices I've taken it from many different looking at many different areas, so I can recommend a few books that I think speak to those areas. Yeah. So Jenny Dean, who is a natural dyer from Sussex, wrote a book called Wild Colours, and that's a really fantastic book for starting out with natural dyeing, because it has a lot of information about the plants, and a lot of the plants are plants that you can grow in the UK, or they're already garden plants that you will be able to find where you live. And it has a very clear recipes and nice colour swatches.
Cool.
And then in terms of foraging, I originally learned foraging from a forager called Fiona Campbell, who's a forager based in Devon. And she wrote a book called The Hunter-Gatherer Way, which is all about reimagining the migratory cycle of how humans would have lived in the UK as hunter-gatherers, and where they would have lived at different times of year, and the plants they would have eaten different times of year. So it's not about dyeing specifically, but it's been very influential to me, her way of working with food. But I've looked at that in terms of dyes as well.
Oh, great. I'm definitely going to check those out. So if people have enjoyed hearing from you and they want to kind of look up your stuff, what you're up to, and the things that you've been describing and making, where are you online, where they can find you?
So I have a website, which is called plantsandcolour.co.uk. And I'm also quite active on Instagram, which I'm plants_and_colour.
Cool.
Those are the best places to find me online.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for doing this. It's been so fascinating to talk to you. I actually I've got one experience of natural dyeing, which is I took part in a masterclass one afternoon where I used to work at the Institute of Making. And I'm going to hold up this to the camera so that you can see it. It's like a little pink square, which I think must have been, did you say avocado was pink?
Yeah.
So I dyed this wool and then knitted it up into a little coaster.
That's sweet. It looks like it's got little flecks of blue in it as well.
Yeah, we tie-dyed it, so the blue is kind of the undyed stuff, and the pink was the dyed stuff. It's a magical transformation, and like you say, actually quite empowering to tap into all of these kind of untapped resources that you would think, you know, normally you just throw all that onion skins and, you know, kitchen debris away into the bin. So there is something very special about harvesting that and using it for good. So thank you so much for telling me about your practice. It's been great, and I hope we can keep in touch, and I'm looking forward to seeing all your next adventures.
Thanks, Anna. Thanks for organising this. It's been great to chat with you.
So that was the fantastic Flora Arbuthnot. Thanks so much to her for coming on the podcast, and definitely check out her stuff online. It's truly beautiful. That's everything for this week. As always, it would be awesome if you could like and subscribe to the podcast so as not to miss out on future episodes. If you want to support us financially with a one-time donation, you can do so at supporter.acast.com/handmade. Thanks so much to everyone who has already done that, which really does help to keep us going. Say hi on social media. On Twitter, we're at Real Talk, that's R-I-A-L Talk, and on Instagram at Handmade Pod. Huge thanks as always to Dave Shepherd for our cover art and to Alex Lathbridge for the music mix. Next week, I'll be talking to guitar maker Tom Sands about wood. So until then, take very good care and I look forward to chatting to you next week on Handmade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.